It is a bit unnerving, sitting here for the first time, and it has taken a lot of preparation, and I have indeed been blessed by all that I have learned, and I hope that you can all learn a little tonight about the gospel too. So Mark is one of four gospels, and it's one of the three synoptic gospels. And synoptic is taken from two Greek words that mean to see together. So the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke all give us accounts of the life and the miracles and the death and resurrection of Jesus. John, on the other hand, is more concerned with the identity of Jesus. So if we have three Gospels that tell us all roughly the same thing, why have three of them? Well, each of them is written from a slightly different viewpoint for a slightly different reason, to pinpoint something different about Jesus and to a different audience. Think about it as if a famous person has just died. We don't get all the information about them all at once. First of all, we'll get short snippets to tell us something about their life, maybe in the obituary. And then people want to know more about what they've said. So we'll get their writings or their letters or scripts from them. And then people are more concerned to know about their character, who they are, what were their motivations. And the Gospels loosely follow this. Mark is the first Gospel, and it's short, to the point, and it tells us about the life of Jesus. Luke and Matthew spend more time telling us about the teaching and the preaching. And then John tells us about the identity. So although all the Gospels are distinctive, together they come together and tell us more about Jesus, so we have a rounded view of who Jesus was. Jesus is one person, but they all emphasize something different. So Mark emphasizes that Jesus is the Son of Man, the servant king. Luke emphasizes he's the savior of the world. Matthew, that he's the king of the Jews. And John, that he is the Son of God. And as I said, they all write to slightly different audiences. So Mark was writing to a Roman audience, a Gentile audience. So his book is action-packed. It's full of interesting detail that will draw someone in. It starts with a bold statement. Matthew, on the other hand, is written to Jews. So it starts with a genealogy because it tells people that Jesus is the rightful heir, the son of David. Luke starts with an account that tells us how he's collected all his information and for what purpose he's collected it. And John starts with a bold statement about eternity, because for him, it's all about convincing everyone that Jesus is indeed the Son of God. So we say that Mark's gospel came first, and it was written in anywhere between 45 and 66 AD, depending on what you read. So why wasn't it written as soon as Jesus died? Well, the primary method of transferring information would have been oral. And many of the disciples would have believed that Jesus was coming back again before they died. So there was no need to write it down. So between 33 AD and when the first gospel was written, most of the information was conveyed by the apostles, the disciples of the apostles. And it wasn't until the disciples started to be persecuted, imprisoned, martyred, and were dying off that it became imperative that the word of God was written down. So why do we think that Mark was the first gospel? Well, Mark can be divided into 105 sections. Of those, 95 occur in Matthew and 81 in Luke. There are 661 books, verses in Mark. In Matthew, there are 1,068, and in Luke, there are 1,149. Of those 661 verses in Mark, 606 of them are reproduced in the book of Matthew. And 51% of them are used exactly as they are found in Mark. In Luke, he uses 320 of the verses, and 53% of them are taken directly out of the book of Mark. So of the 55 verses that Matthew doesn't use, Luke uses 31 of them, leaving only 24 verses in Mark that don't occur in either Luke or Matthew. So it looks to us as if the book of Mark is used as a basis for the other two gospels. And Luke himself tells us that he studied other accounts to come up with his gospel. So who is Mark? Well, Mark doesn't tell us who he is in the gospel, except for maybe one occasion when we read a peculiar story that is only recorded in Mark. And this occurs in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus has been arrested, and we hear of a man, a young man, who was wearing a linen garment, some say a sheet, some just say an outer garment was thrown in hurriedly with nothing underneath. And we hear that a Roman soldier grabs hold of the garment and the young man flees naked. Kind of a strange thing to include if that wasn't Mark talking about himself. And also, it could explain why we know what Jesus prayed when he prayed in the garden. Maybe that is Mark who crept in and is hiding and listening to Jesus, because we know it wasn't the disciples who told us what Jesus prayed because they were asleep. But what we do know about Mark is that he is John Mark, that he is the son of Mary, who would have been a well-to-do, respected woman in Jerusalem. She opened her house to the early church and to the early believers. And it is believed that when Peter escaped miraculously from prison, it was to her house that he went. So Mark would have been around believers from an early age. We also know that Mark was the nephew of Barnabas. And Barnabas and Paul took missionary journeys together. On their first one, Mark went with Barnabas and Paul. But it didn't end well. And Mark ends up coming away before the end of the trip. We don't know why, but we do know that it causes such a rift that on the second trip, when Barnabas wants Mark to go, Paul refuses and they split. So Paul goes with Silas and Barnabas takes Mark. But we do know that they are reconciled before the end of Paul's life, because in Colossians, we read that he's imprisoned in Rome. And Mark is there with him. In Philemon, we are told that Mark is a fellow believer with Paul. And when the end is near, Paul calls on Timothy and says, come and bring Mark. So whatever he's done, he's been redeemed. We also know that Mark is a personal assistant to the Apostle Paul. It's believed that he traveled around with Peter. We believe that he traveled around with Peter as his interpreter, as he traveled through the churches in Rome. So often Mark's gospel is credited as being the eyewitness account of Peter. So how can we attest to the accuracy of Mark's gospel? Well, if it is indeed Peter's account, it is an eyewitness account. Also, Mark was known by the apostles and the early church. And if there had been any doubt about what he was writing, they would have confronted him. Also, his works would have been circulated in the early church. They would have been living through these events. They would know and be able to attest the truth of them. So there would have been lots of things written about Jesus in the early days, but not all of them make it into our canon, our Holy Bible. To make it into the canon, they had to be written by an apostle or the disciple of apostle. They had to be historically sound, doctrinally accurate, and accepted as truth by the early church. Well, Mark ticks all those boxes, so we can say that it is an accurate gospel. Mark tells us a lot of facts about Jesus' lives in a simple and in a dramatic way. He begins with a declaration of faith, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He leaves us in no doubt as to who he believes Jesus is. And then he spends the rest of the book backing up that statement, proving that Jesus is the Son of God, the Son of Man, the Servant King. He repeatedly speaks of people's reactions to Jesus. They were astonished by his teachings. They were amazed. And of the disciples, he tells us, they are full of awe. They were utterly astonished. Mark's gospel tells us the human side of Jesus. It tells us the emotions of Jesus. Jesus sighed deeply in his spirit. He was moved with compassion. He marveled at their unbelief. He was moved to righteous anger. Only Mark tells us that when the young ruler came and asked him, "What do I do to get to the kingdom of heaven?" that Jesus loved him. Jesus could feel pangs of hunger. He could feel tired. He needed rest. He was human. And Mark shows us that humanity. And he adds eyewitnesses accounts that some of the other gospels don't add. So in the book of Matthew and in the book of Mark, we hear about Jesus bringing the little children to him. But the book of Mark adds that he took them into his arms. When we hear about Jesus feeding the 5,000, it's only in Mark that we learn that they were sat in hundreds and in 50s. And when the storm rose up on the lake, when Jesus was asleep in the boat, we're told by Mark that he was asleep with his head on a pillow. They're little facts, eyewitness accounts, that add clarity to a story, that draw us into that story. And it's only Mark that tells us on that last journey he made with his disciples that he went on in front of them. It shows us the loneliness of Jesus. Now, Mark's style isn't polished and it isn't well put together. It's told quickly, it's rapid. It's one statement added to another, the way a child might tell a story. And it's joined with the word "and" repeatedly. He uses the words "immediately" and "straight away" over 30 times. He's in a hurry to tell the story. Mark's gospel has a very peculiar ending. The original manuscripts end in chapter 16, halfway through verse 8. And they actually end in the Greek halfway through a sentence. It says, "For they were afraid of." Now, in the English, it's been tidied up to say they feared or they were afraid. But it seems a strange way to end a gospel. But theologians haven't been able to agree on why it ended that way. Some say that Mark intended it to end that way, that he wanted to leave us in a state of tension between faith and fear to make a decision for ourselves. Others, that Mark was prevented from finishing the gospel, either by persecution or maybe he was dead. Or others, that the ending was lost in some way, that maybe it was mutilated by persecutors, or even some believe that Peter maybe tore it off. After all, it's supposed to be Peter's eyewitness account of Jesus. Maybe he wanted to include the preaching of Jesus, but not the personal. We know from 1 Corinthians that one time after his resurrection, when he appeared to his disciples, it was just to Peter that he appeared to. And it was a very personal, intimate moment. Maybe Peter didn't want that included. We'll never know why the ending of the gospel is missing, or whether indeed it is even missing. But we do know that an ending has been added to make it neater and to finish it off. And there's a shorter version and a longer version. And the longer version is usually what we see in our Bibles now. And it just tells us that Jesus came back, that he appeared to his disciples, he went back to heaven, and that the disciples then went out and preached the good news. So different scholars have divided the book of Mark in different ways. But the simplest way of studying it is in two parts with a joining part. So chapters 1-8 ask the question, who is Jesus? And chapters 11-16 show us how Jesus is the messianic king. And the section in the middle between chapter 8, verse 27 and the end of chapter 10 answers that question. Jesus brings the two halves together. So the book starts with a declaration. Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. And it quickly goes on to tell us about Jesus's baptism and how the heavens opened and a dove came down and a voice from heaven says, "You are my dearly loved son. You bring me great joy." Jesus is announced from heaven. It is clear that he is the Son of God. But then in the first half of the book, Jesus spends all of his time telling people, don't tell people about your healing. So why would Jesus not want people to know who he was? Well, probably for a number of reasons. Firstly, it would have misrepresented Jesus. He didn't want to be known just as a healer. That wasn't his primary purpose. His primary purpose was to teach people, to bring them the good news. In chapter 1, verse 38, we're told he had been healing many people. And he tells his disciples, it's time we move on. We've got to go somewhere else. I am here to preach. There are more people that need to hear. Secondly, an open testimony at that time would have led to a superficial response. People would have come and sought Jesus out. They would have wanted healing, but had no, they wouldn't have understood the repentance and the faith that he was teaching. And lastly, it would have hindered his ministry, which is exactly what it does. After Jesus heals a man of leprosy, with leprosy, he tells him sternly, don't tell anyone, but go to the priest and have yourself declared clean. But the man tells everyone. And then we find in verse 45 that Jesus tells us as large, Mark tells us as large crowds, and that Jesus can no longer come into the town and he has to stay in secluded places. The first half of Mark gives us a glimpse into the life of Jesus. In the first chapter, between verses 21 and 34, we get a day in the life of Jesus. And it's hurried and it's rapid, and it starts in the synagogue and then it goes to a crowded room, and then it moves to an individual, and then we're back to a crowd. There's lots of action. There's lots of drama. It's also in this first section that we see Jesus casting out evil spirits and silencing them. People may not have known who Jesus was, but the evil spirits do. And the spirit proclaims, Jesus of Nazareth, the Holy One of God, what are you going to do with us? What do you want with us? And Jesus quietens him and casts him out. It's also here that we find Jesus first in prayer. After a full and busy day, Jesus gets up early the next day before sunrise to pray. And his disciples come and look for him. And this is pivotal, because while everyone is looking for Jesus, Jesus is looking to God. Three times in the book of Mark, we hear about Jesus's praying. Here, after he feeds the 5,000, and in the Garden of Gethsemane. We don't get far into the book of Mark and into Jesus's ministry before the conflict begins. Between the beginning of the second chapter of Mark and chapter 3, verse 6, Mark records five incidences that all have an element of conflict in them, culminating in a threat to kill him. The religious leaders were offended by Jesus's claims, by the company he kept, and by his apparent disregard for their culture. The first occasion is when a lame man comes through the ceiling, lowered by his friends, to Jesus. And Jesus forgives him his sins and heals him. Now, the religious leaders knew that only the offended could forgive the offender. So only God could forgive sins. To them, this was blasphemy from Jesus, because they had no concept that Jesus was God. Secondly, Jesus calls Levi, who's a tax collector, and tells him to follow him. And Levi does. He gets up and follows him. And that night, he holds a party, a banquet, and invites all his friends and colleagues, because he wants them to meet Jesus. But the Pharisees can't believe that Jesus is mixing with this riffraff. They're horrified. Thirdly, Jesus is asked why his disciples don't fast. John's disciples fasted, the Pharisees fasted, but Jesus and his disciples didn't. Well, fasting had become ritualistic. It had become showy. The Pharisees did it in a showy fashion. And Jesus explains that he has come to bring something new, and it's something that doesn't fit in to all that legalism. He's not saying that fasting is bad. He's just saying that there's a time for fasting. Fasting is for a time of sorrow. And that wasn't appropriate while Jesus was alive. And last two incidences of conflict occur together on the same day. Jesus and his followers are going through a field on the Sabbath, and his followers are picking ears of corn and eating them, which was allowed. They weren't stealing it. It's just the fact that it was done on the Sabbath. And later that day, Jesus heals a man's deformed hand. Now, Jews are not permitted to work on the Sabbath. And this is something that the Pharisees then bring to Jesus' attention. And Jesus retorts by telling them that the Sabbath was created to meet the needs of people and not for people to meet the requirements of the Sabbath. At this point, the Pharisees have had enough. They start to plot to kill Jesus. And it's from Mark 3 to Mark 6 that we see a new phase in Jesus' ministry. He moves away from the religious leaders, and he takes his disciples, and he starts to react, to act with the people around him. Now, the people around him, it takes a message to, are happy to hear his good news. He's popular with them, unlike with the religious rulers. However, it's a superficial understanding. People come from miles to see him, but more because they've heard about his miracles. They come for healing without any understanding of who Jesus was. It seems that at that time, only the evil spirits understood how Jesus was. It's also about this time that people are starting to form opinions about Jesus. Mark tells us a story that's only in his gospel about Jesus entering a house and it becoming so crowded that he doesn't even have time to eat. And his family hears about this and they come and try and take him away, saying that he's out of his mind. Maybe they considered him to be fanatical, or maybe they just knew that this path would inevitably lead to confrontation and to conflict. At the same time, the teachers of the law arrive from Jerusalem and they accuse him of being possessed by Satan. Now here, Jesus makes a statement that has troubled and confused Christians ever since. He says, "I tell you the truth, all sin and blasphemy can be forgiven, but anyone who blasphemes the Holy Spirit will never be forgiven. This is a sin with eternal consequences." Many people have wondered, have I committed the unforgivable sin? Well, to ask that question means that you're aware of sin and you're concerned about sin. Therefore, you can't have committed an unforgivable sin. The religious leaders were attributing the work of God to Satan. They didn't recognize that good works came from God. They willfully rejected the truth. They rejected Christ. The unforgivable sin is deliberately and knowingly rejecting Christ. It's not an isolated incident. It's not a willful attitude. You can't commit it accidentally or unknowingly. It is an indifference to sin. It is a cynical rejection of grace. It is to have a clear knowledge of the way of forgiveness, but deliberately choose to reject it. If you choose not to accept Christ and there is no repentance, there can be no forgiveness. Up until now, Mark has shown us Jesus acting He's shown us action of what he's doing and his miracles. But in chapter 4, he shows us Jesus's key teaching method, parables. On the surface, a parable was a harmless story, but they exploded with powerful meaning. The reason Jesus used parables was a way to express profound truths in a simple, down-to-earth way. But he was subtle about how he released his truths. Jesus revealed enough in his teachings that people could respond in faith. And when they responded, he gave them more. A parable would sort out those that just came for miracles and those that came to listen and learn. Chapter 4 ends with another busy day of teaching. Jesus and his disciples leave the crowds behind and they take a boat. Jesus is exhausted and he falls asleep in the back of the boat with his head on a pillow. When a violent storm comes up, his disciples are scared and they shout to Jesus, "Teacher, don't you care that we're going to drown?" Jesus wakes up and he calms the storm. And he asks his disciples, "Why are you afraid?" And now Mark tells us they've gone from being scared of the storm to being terrified. They're no longer scared of the storm, but they have this awe and wonder of this person that's in the boat with them. This person that has the authority over disease and over demons and now even over nature. Chapter 5 goes on to record a series of amazing incidents where from Jesus' ministry. We see him powerfully meeting the needs of the people. In the most desperate situations, Jesus is there. But the beginning of chapter 6 shows us the limit to what he can do when people don't have faith. He's returned to his hometown of Nazareth, where he's met with a cool reception. In fact, more than a cool reception, they scoff at him. And it tells us that he is prevented from doing everything he would like to do because of their lack of unbelief. And Mark tells us he is amazed by their unbelief. So next we see Jesus, and he's putting his disciples through a training session. He sends them out with a mission to cast out evil spirits. But they also have to learn total dependence on God because they're not allowed to take anything with them. And then before we read more about Jesus's miracles and another confrontation with the religious leaders who are, again, annoyed that he's not keeping their customs. But before that, we learn about the death of John the Baptist. And this brings us to the close of the first half of the book. And it transitions into the next part of the book with a healing. And Jesus is healing a blind man. But he heals him in stages. He doesn't see clearly immediately. And maybe this is a metaphor for how Jesus's disciples see him. They don't see clearly who he is all at once. It takes time for them to see him. And now we come to the pivotal verse. In chapter 8, verse 27, Jesus is alone with his disciples. And he asks the apparently casual question, "Who do people say I am?" And then comes the all important question. He asks his disciples, "Who do you say I am?" And Peter answers without hesitation, "You are the Messiah." Well, Jesus accepts this truth and then goes on to tell them that they shouldn't tell other people. So why still in this ministry does Jesus not want people to know that he's the Messiah? Well, people had different views of what a Messiah would be, politically or with force. And Jesus didn't fill either of these. He wasn't a military leader. He wasn't a political leader. But people would have the wrong impression of Jesus as a Messiah if they knew. Secondly, he always wanted people to discover the truth for themselves. Those with eyes to see could see for themselves who Jesus was. They would recognize the truth. Jesus knew that the only faith worth having was one that was born from conviction and not coercion. So from this point on in the story, Jesus starts to explain to his disciples how he will become the messianic king, and it's not how they would expect. He tells them that he's going to suffer many things, that he's going to be rejected and he's going to be killed, but that he will rise again. Peter can't cope with this idea of a Messiah that is going to suffer and die, and he tells Jesus off. In return, Jesus rebukes Peter. It must be the temptation that Jesus has faced throughout his ministry. Take an easier path. Avoid the cross. But this time that temptation is coming from the lips of his friends, rather than in the wilderness experience where it was Satan tempting him. And then he shocks his disciples more by telling them that anyone that wants to be his disciple must take up their cross and follow him. That true discipleship was surrendering completely to Jesus, identifying with him. It was suffering with him. It was complete obedience. But also, if we suffer with Christ, we share in his glory. And he demonstrated this to his disciples 6 days later when they witnessed the transfiguration. Jesus takes Peter, James, and John, and they go to the top of the mountain. And there he reveals his glory. Moses and Elijah appear with him. Moses represents the law and Elijah the prophets. And Jesus is there as a fulfillment of both of them. This would have been a time that was irrefutable to the disciples that here is the Messiah. It might also have been a time of refreshment for Jesus and something that the disciples could hang on to when times got bad. Three times during this transition section, Mark tells us that Jesus tells his disciples about what is to come. This section also tells us about the disciples when they fail to cast out a demon because of their lack of prayer, and also tells us about the disciples arguing about who is the greatest. They still had a lot to learn. During this time, they are geographically traveling towards Jerusalem. And then in chapter 10, Jesus turns everyday things upside down. People and things that don't usually matter became important, and the rich and successful find themselves on the outside looking in. He's questioned again by the Pharisees, this time about divorce. He blesses the children. He mourns the fact that a young ruler won't give up his most treasured possession on earth, money, to follow Jesus. This section of Mark, the transition section, ends the way it began, with a miracle, a healing of a blind man. And it is the last miracle that's recorded in the Gospels. This man is healed because of his faith in Jesus. He sees Jesus because of his faith, and we too see Jesus because of our faith. The remaining chapters in Mark are dedicated to the last week of Jesus's life. We've rushed through the last 2.5 years of Jesus's ministry, and now we slow down and we focus on how Jesus is to become the messianic king. Chapter 11 starts with Jesus making a public statement about his identity. He arrives in Jerusalem and he enters on a donkey. This is to fulfill prophecy in Zechariah 9:9 that says, "See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, on the foal of a donkey." Now, this isn't included in Mark because Mark is writing to the Romans who don't know prophecy. But the triumphal entry is something that they would have been familiar with. When a Roman general had won a battle, he would come back and he would be rewarded with a triumphal entry. He would be in a chariot and people would be shouting his praises. but not Jesus. Jesus the King enters not on a war animal, but an animal of peace, on the foal of a donkey. Now the crowds welcome Jesus, and it's genuine, but it's superficial. It's an expression of their enthusiasm. Jesus makes his way to the temple, but it's late, so he leaves with his disciples. The following day, Jesus condemns a fig tree and cleanses the temple. Both are symbolic acts that illustrate the sad spiritual state of Israel. In spite of its many privileges and opportunities, it is outwardly fruitless, like the fig tree, and inwardly corrupt, like the market traders in the temple. It's unusual for Jesus to sit in judgment, yet there comes a time when God can do nothing else but judge. The following day, the disciples see that the fig tree is withered, and Jesus uses this as an opportunity to teach them about prayer. He tells them that a mountain can be thrown into the sea with prayer if you believe it. He says, if you believe in anything, you will receive it. Now, this is often taken out of context, and this is where the prosperity gospel has grown from, the name it and claim it. But it's one verse, and it's not the only verse that Jesus teaches about prayer. And you can't take it out of context from the other scriptures. Other scriptures tell us that you must be in the will of God when you pray. And the person that prays must be abiding in God and seeking his will. Prayer is not an emergency measure to call on in times of need. It's a communication constantly and the worship of God. We shouldn't interpret it to mean that if we pray hard enough about anything, that those prayers are going to come true. Because that's not a belief and a faith in God. It's a faith in faith. The purpose of prayer is not to have man's will done in heaven, but to have God's will done on earth. Jesus again enters into the temple, and he's challenged by the teachers and the religious leaders of the law. They want to know by what authority Jesus is doing all this. How does he have the right to turn over all the tables in the temple? Well, Jesus answers their question with a question of his own, one that only has two answers. He asks them, by what authority did John the Baptist baptize? They can't answer this question because it's going to make them unpopular in the eyes of the crowd. So the challenge goes unanswered. Jesus is challenging the motives. He's challenging what lies behind their questions. And they aren't prepared to recognize that God gives authority. So the second part of the book of Mark records more of the teachings of Jesus. Chapter 12 records a parable that's more of an allegory. We are clearly meant to see that God is the owner of the vineyard and that the tenant farmers are the religious leaders of the time. Over the years, they have continually rejected God's message and God's messengers. And now they are about to kill the son. But the parable ends on a note of hope. Though they have rejected the son, he becomes the cornerstone. God is doing something wonderful. The religious leaders realize that they are the wicked farmers in this story. And they want to arrest Jesus. But there's crowds of people around him. So they withdraw. But he faces more challenges and more questions from the religious leaders. They're trying to catch him out. Firstly, they ask him about taxes and then about the resurrection, followed on by which is the most important commandment. Jesus uses his time to teach the people. And at the end of chapter 12, he criticizes the religious leaders, both for their showmanship and for their religious practices. He takes the time to correct them and they don't get it. He pleases the crowds, but he angers the religious leaders. In Mark 13, we see a farewell message to his disciples. His aim is not to satisfy their curiosity about the future, but to encourage their faith and to help them face the challenges that lie ahead. Jesus warns the disciples against relying on man-made structures and religious trimmings. Instead, they are to look forward to a time when Jesus is coming back. Jesus also warns his followers of the dangers that are to come. He tells them that they must expect opposition, and not just from religious leaders and secular authorities, but also from their family. At the time Mark would have been writing this, he would have already been seeing persecution, imprisonment, martyrdom. And these verses would have offered hope and comfort, because people would have known that this is still part of the plan, that Jesus has predicted this. Jesus also warns them about deception. He tells them that people will come claiming to be the Messiah, but they mustn't be misled. And thirdly, Jesus warns them that because they see these signs that the end is coming, they shouldn't be distracted. They shouldn't think that the end is just around the corner. They shouldn't panic, and they shouldn't be diverted from their task of preaching the gospel. A statement that's as pertinent to us today as it was to them then. In this section, Jesus also teaches that dark days will come to an end and Jesus will return. And he uses a parable to illustrate this. They must be on their guard and they must be ready for Christ's return. The return of Christ will be unprecedented, unmistakable, and unexplained. It'll be unexpected. He will come to complete God's plan, to judge all of mankind and to deliver his people. Now we're into the final act of Mark, and it begins with the Passover preparation and an act of a devotion by a woman who's unnamed in Mark, who pours expensive perfume over Jesus's head. Her actions provoke criticism from some of Jesus's disciples, but Jesus recognizes that it is an act of pure devotion. And in stark contrast to this, we learn about Judas, who goes to betray Jesus. The religious authorities needed someone who could direct them towards Jesus when the crowds weren't around him. And Judas stands up to be that person. And for his trouble, he's paid the price of a slave. Well, next we read about the Last Supper, the farewell meal between Jesus and his friends. And Jesus fills the familiar elements of the Passover with a new significance. He takes the bread and he breaks it, and he tells his disciples to see this as a symbol of his body. And then he takes the wine and he tells them to see this as a symbol of his blood. See, he's pointing to truths that the disciples know nothing of yet. He's bringing in a new covenant between God and between man. And all of this is above their heads. But when they look back, after Jesus' death, after Jesus' resurrection, this will make so much more sense to them. And it's within this context at the table that Jesus then tells them that he's going to be betrayed. Jesus knows what's going to happen. After the meal, they all head out to the Mount of Olives. And on the way, Jesus is telling his disciples that they are all going to desert him. He predicts that Peter will deny him three times. And of course, Peter says, "That will never happen. Even if I have to die, I would never desert my Lord." Proud words that we know end up not being true. But because of Peter's humility and his integrity, they are still recorded in his eyewitness account. So they make their way to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus takes Peter, James, and John further into the garden to pray. Jesus becomes greatly distressed. His anguish is real and it's intense. And he cries out to God, is there another way? He knows he's going to experience total separation from God. And he's asking, is there another way for sinners to be reconciled to God? He returns to his disciples and he finds them asleep. Three times he goes to pray. He expresses his trust in his Father. And he willingly submits to the Father's will as the only way to bring salvation. Judas then betrays Jesus with a kiss. Jesus is arrested. He offers no resistance, and his disciples flee. And we hear about the young man that runs off naked. At the end of chapter 14, Jesus is given a preliminary hearing, and Peter denies Jesus three times, just as Jesus predicted. That this is still recorded in this book was a sign that Peter was not too proud to tell the whole world about his failure. From chapter 15 and chapter 16, we hear the story of Jesus' trial, of his execution, and his resurrection. It's told with moving simplicity. It's told plainly and convincingly. At the beginning of chapter 15, Jesus has been handed over to Pilate, the Roman governor, and various accusations have been brought against him. But Jesus remains silent. Pilate concludes that he is not a revolutionary, but that he's a religious fanatic, and he tries to get him off on two different ploys. But when they're not successful, he bows to the crowd and he delivers Jesus to be killed. Mark tells us of the story of Jesus' journey to the cross, surrounded by insults and abuse, and then how Jesus dies in contrast with quiet dignity. Mark is restrained in his account of the cross. He doesn't dwell on the pain of the nails or the shame of Jesus' nakedness. He just says he was crucified. Mark tells us nothing about the people that were crucified beside him. We learn at noon, a darkness covers the land that lasts for 3 hours. Outer darkness is one of the expressions that Jesus used to describe hell, a total separation from God. And this symbol is confirmed by the only words that Mark records while Jesus is on the cross. My God, why have you abandoned me? As Jesus dies, Mark records that the curtain in the temple was torn in two. And it's here in Jesus' death that we meet a Roman soldier, a Gentile. But he understands at that point who Jesus was. He says, this man was truly the Son of God. What so many religious leaders had missed, this centurion understood. Mark also tells us that where Jesus' disciples had failed, his women followers had not. They remained loyal, and they were eyewitnesses to Jesus' death, to his burial, and to his resurrection. Now, Jesus was saved from hanging on the cross by Joseph of Arimathea. If a body wasn't claimed, it would be left on the cross for wild animals to eat. But Joseph asks for his body. Mark tells us that Joseph was one of the Sanhedrin, the group that condemned Jesus. But all Mark tells us that he was waiting for the kingdom of God. His request for the body would tell us about how he supported Jesus. Mark tells us simply that the tomb was cut out of rock, and that after placing Jesus's body in the tomb, Joseph rolled a stone in front of the entrance. Again, Mark records that the women were present at the tomb. The final chapter of Mark is handled in the same simplistic way that Mark records Jesus's death. The women go to anoint his body, and it's only in Mark we find a conversation with the women recorded. How are we going to roll this stone away from the tomb, they ask. When they get to the tomb, the stone is already moved away. Mark doesn't tell us how it is moved, just simply that it's moved. And they enter into the tomb, and there they see a young man dressed in white. The way Mark describes it, the words he uses could just be a young man, but it has a supernatural inclination towards it. We're supposed to know that this is an angel. Mark uses a word that only he uses in the New Testament to put into mind our scene that is amazement as well as fear. And the angel tries to put the women at rest. He tells them, he's not here, he's resurrected. Go tell his disciples that Jesus is going ahead of you and he's going to meet you again in Galilee. You're going to see him here. But here is where the original manuscript ends. The women flee and say nothing because they're so fearful. But in the longer version that's been added, we hear about Mary running to tell the disciples and them not believing her. And then we hear about Jesus appearing to two more disciples on the road and them telling the rest of the disciples and then not believing them either. And then finally, we hear about Jesus who appears to all of 11 of his disciples and scolds them for not believing. We then hear him telling them to go out to spread the good news. And he's taken back into heaven. And we are left with the disciples spreading the good news to everyone. And that's where we end the book of Mark. So, Bernie.